Derek Harris, who's an artist and curator and one of the founding members of Cubit Gallery, and is also a pathway leader at Wimbledon School of Art. And he will be responded to by Katie Pratt, who's also a painter and also teaches at Wimbledon. Derek, please take the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Now, I'm going to give a talk which is a little bit longer than the prescribed length. It runs to about 13-14 minutes. And there are a number of slides that I will work through. Two or three of them I pick up on directly during the course of the paper. But the rest of the slides I will not make direct mention of. There is a list that should be in your pack which will identify them for you. And they're of tangential kind of relevance as I go through. Okay, so has painting lost its mojo? If it is a given that intention and interpretation are interdependent partners in the production of meaning in contemporary art, then the space between these two has become an axis and a site of exchange between maker and viewer. After a brief look at the range of critical and academic mechanisms that traditionally process this exchange, I will move on to consider the limitations that may have resulted, particularly in the case of painting, and its loss of mojo. If serious art has to function as activism in order to demonstrate its criticality, then an aesthetic experience is no longer a central requirement of art. I believe that this is the conclusion we are forced to consider if we look at the late postmodern condition of culture and the historic trajectory of the avant-garde. To expand on this a little, I would like to ask, what is meant by criticality? What do I mean by criticality? In order to get to grips with this question, it may be helpful to turn to The Abuse of Beauty by Arthur C. Danto. In the chapter Beauty and Politics, Danto sets out what he terms the inherited 20th century avant-garde prerequisite for art as activism. He argues that this reached a high watermark with the 1993 Whitney Biennial in New York, when the Rodney King beating video, The Real Story, was included in the exhibition. The video artwork was captured by a non-artist bystander who witnessed a gross miscarriage of justice. In a notorious incident, a group of white LAPD officers meted out an unprovoked beating of an innocent black citizen. Danto concludes, therefore, that contemporary art is characterized by aesthetic uninflection, meaning that aesthetic qualities are absent and unnecessary. This example of art as activism was symptomatic, Danto argued, of the prerequisite need for contemporary art to demonstrate its socio-political relevance and intellectual legitimacy, its criticality. Where does that leave beauty? We might also ask, where does that leave painting? The aura of the original gesture, aesthetic spectacle, sensory encounter with color, etc., etc. Barry Schwabsky reminds us in his introduction to Vitamin P, 2004, of the late postmodern condition of painting, that of being self-conscious in self-conscious dialogue with its own past, thereby demonstrating its critical self-reflexivity and acknowledging the historical paradigm in which it rests. Quote, a painting is not just a painting, but also the representation of an idea about painting. This is a reason why there is so little contradiction between abstract and representational painting. In both cases, the painting is not there to represent the image. The image exists in order to represent the painting, that is, the painting's idea of painting. Close quote. After reflecting on this quotation and considering an optional beauty, as Danto suggests, where the inflection of aesthetic qualities can legitimately coexist within an artwork, provided it meets certain politically engaged and self-reflexive criticality, provided it meets requirements of politically engaged and self-reflexive criticality. Danto suggests that an optional beauty might be employed when certain critical rules of engagement are observed. Despite all of the above, or rather because of the above, I would like to turn to the virtues of the painted surface itself. Assume a painted image is inflected with attitude, and the viewer is affected by the emotional inflection or painterly sensibility infused in the painted surface. Then the way in which an image, sign, symbol is rendered alters what it means. It also follows that we might consider the impact of the viewer's emotional motivation when we ascribe cultural meaning to a work of art. If we are motivated by our feelings as well as reasoned argument, then we are more likely to take action, social political action, if our emotional intelligence is engaged and the message is inflected. Thus, we can argue for a painting that has both an intellectual context and a purposeful aesthetic dimension. The term mojo, why the term mojo? I mean it here not just as an easy phrase taken from the vernacular of youth culture, but refer to Jez Butterworth's recent play, Mojo, which sets the scene of London in the late 50s, a moment of British working life that set the gritty tone of an emergent popular culture. This was around the time when American high modernism firmly closed its grip around the leading painting manifesto of the day, Greenbergian formalism. Successive and rapid cycles of modernist reductionism followed this and were played out through painting as its purity waned. The framing device of the manifesto emerged as the winner in this particular narrative episode of a contest between intention and interpretation. Early conceptual art required prior reading of a text, determining the rules of engagement and interpretive context. This framework prescribed the meaning of an artwork in advance of the viewer's aesthetic encounter with the object. Triumph Over Mastery 2, made by Mark Tansey in 2006, is a retrospective depiction of a heroic worker who, in whitewashing the Sistine Chapel, becomes the painter erasing his own shadow. Tansey skillfully depicts an image of the painter at work, and as Schwabsky reminds us, this is painting as reflexive representation of the idea of a painter painting. So as a consequence of this historical narrative, painters now required to submit to one contextual framework or another. As the author's intention is academicized, interpretation imposed, and meanings defined within the parameters of critical, reflexive, and ironic discourse, paint will conform to a reading as hybridization of image and gesture, iconography, sign, and linguistic cipher. It must play within a self-conscious framework of expressive fallacy and familiarize itself with devices like irony, parody, and pastiche, which distance the senses. These tasks performed, the late postmodern art object is ready for cultural consumption. If we reconsider our motivations to act and the potential role of emotive inflections in painting, I mentioned a little earlier, then the infusion of emotional sensibility becomes key to the critical function of the artwork. It is in this way that the experience of the aesthetic and poetic qualities of a painting as object may determine a different framework of reference, an optical realm of senses in which we can be inspired and moved and motivated to act. Is this alter aesthetic or alter real aesthetic a method we can recognize, a mode of apprehending through which we might experience a moment of empathic connection, an emotional connection with whoever transmuted the ordinary matter of the pigmented surface in the first place, whenever they lived? James Elkins, professor of art history at the School of the Art Institute at Chicago, argues that like alchemists, quote, like alchemists, painters are bound up in a hypostatic contemplation. Paint seems irresistibly to meme, as if the littlest daub must signify something. Close quote. Elkins, What is Painting? As a medium, painting is constituted of inert pigment suspended in a range of binding oils and compounds. I contest that the flow and form of a painter's intention is synthesized in and through the medium, and that the conflation of concept, strategy, and sensory intuition can result in a transformative process in and of itself. That is to say, the substance or the materiality of paint is the embodiment and realization of a theo-alchemical transformative process, as Elkins proposes. If we understand hypostasis as a base substance or corporeal foundation on which something abstract rests, and as Elkins describes, quote, a hypostasis is a descent from an incorporeal state into ordinary matter, or in general, an infusion of spirit into something inert. It can describe the feeling that numbers have, quote unquote, souls and formal lives. And it can explain the notion that two fluids mingling in a bottle or on a canvas are somehow expressing a state of mind, close quote. In a secular context then, can we say that ordinary matter of pigment, the materiality, facture, skill, crafted nuance, and the painted surface becomes charged with the metaphysical hypostasis, charged with transformative potential? Two questions. As Elkins proposes, are comparisons between painting and alchemy useful or relevant? And is there a place for this dialogue in a contemporary art debate? When we consider painting, what does the transformation of substance into process mean? I would like to propose a new authenticity, a hypostatic expressionism, where uncontrolled, de-skilled painting processes endure, making no claims for the purity of self-expression, Instead, they explore the transformative powers of paint as substance, substance as process, Elkins. Elkins has developed this idea in parallel with his understanding of alchemy and alchemical processes. If substances do not speak clearly to us, it is because they are mute, dumb, inarticulate materiality. Meaning is a projection of the viewer's moods and thoughts. As Elkins says, quote, painters have to work in a morass of stubborn substances, close quote. And, quote, substances are like mirrors that let us see things we do not quite understand, close quote. In painting, there is the hypostatic feeling of the artist, the maker, infused into the surface too. Is it possible to interpret the painter's hypostatic feelings in a painted surface that may also incorporate pictorial depiction? Or are we bound instead by the need to privilege traditional tools of interpretation, the determinants of criticality, in order to make meaning? Elkins suggests that a way to approach this might be to analyze the marks as evidence of the motions of the painter's body, an indexical matrix of gestures. But how different is this to a nostalgia for high modernism's abstract expressionism, the arc of Pollock's drips, the swing of de Kooning's gestures? Perhaps the answer lies in Elkins' notion of the theo-alchemical and what we might call hypostatic agency. Painting as a secular medium of collaboration. Alchemy is nearly always theo-alchemy, in the sense that its primary purpose is God's work, to investigate the transmutation of base metals into gold. As Elkins says, they understood what they were, quote, were rehearsing and often speeding up, processes that the earth does naturally by brewing metals underground. That work was God's, and it was the ongoing perfection of the world, close quote. If the alchemists were indeed theo-alchemists, and they were operating in a theological context then, what relevance might this activity hold in the secular context of criticality? To summarise, if we are if we are motivated to act by an attitude of painterly inflection imparted to a painting by its maker, and we experience some form of secular empathy with the hypostatic feeling of that same author, then are we not collaborating in an experience? An experience triggered by the dull, inert substance that sits on the surface of the canvas, a substance that is reanimated by its mojo and transformed in the act of beholding. If so, then the substance of paint is the process through which paint itself, as a dumb materiality, can mean. Paint and criticality are indivisible. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Terry. Okay. Now, Katie, would you like to respond to that directly, and then we'll discuss it for a little bit, and then have a few short questions from the floor. Thanks, Katie.
It's going to be quite formal. There's been some late changes to the paper, but one of the very helpful later changes that came in was Derek posing a couple of questions, and the second one, when we consider painting, what does the transformation of substance into process mean? I think that question nicely draws together both the Danto text that Derek cited and Elkins that lots of people are indexing today. And I'd also like to add into it that it's not just the idea of transforming the substance through process, but also, as Derek says in his paper, the additional experience that the viewer brings, you know, the transformation under the gaze. And I would perhaps crystallize it by asking from the Danto and the Elkins text as well, to what extent is intentionality kind of deliberate, cognitive, there seems to be an assumption that every emotive or experiential trigger in the work is somehow determined or chosen by the artist, but of course there is this a gap between what the artist intends and what the artist actually achieves, and also what the viewer brings compared to the artist's experience. So the viewer's additional understanding or translation of some interpretation of something because of their own experience. I also wanted to make a couple of other points. I mean, Elkins assumes that the artist is somehow swept up in a frenzy during the making process, that there's some kind of trance-like state, and that somehow interrupts the sense of intention in a work, which I find, and I think Derek does too, contentious. And the idea that the outcome is not determined or controlled, but is alchemical, because he's saying that the artist is somehow bamboozled by the substance of paint, that it's something they don't quite understand, have no hope of understanding, and just using it as quite dumbly. And Danto also, alternatively, has this idea that an artist is either trying to illustrate a specific emotion, cognitively eliciting a specific emotion, or which he says might run counter to, or also perhaps alternatively be juxtaposed with beauty. But he's I wanted to point out that I find both those positions, both Danto's and Elkins' positions, actually, I don't suppose you expect me to say this, quite macho. I find Elkins quite macho because of the idea of frenzy, and as Derek was citing, an indexical matrix of gestures, and you cited Pollock and
de Kooning.
An idea of expression that is incredibly assertive. Dante's perspective, it's this assertive emotion. And I think that Derek's example of in a sense, introducing painting to a much, much greater degree than these other two commentators. Because for Elkins, the idea of painting is a kind of dumb substance that we're not in control of, and it's and he assumes it's all oil and mud, I think that when Derek talks about the idea of introducing painting in terms of aura, gesture, sensory encounter, I think that that is part of what you call the mojo, or the hypostasis, how you pronounce it. And the other point I wanted to make about both Danto and Elkins is that they... Danto, when he talks about beauty, and he talks about it as fulfilling... when Danto talks about beauty, he's talking about it as opposed to this idea of critical activism, he suggests that perhaps it runs counter. It's inconsistent with the possibility of having a kind of manifesto, a political agenda or a social agenda to the work, and Elkins too, with his alchemical, as Derek says, they have this kind of moral religious agenda to it, which I don't find personally particularly helpful, the idea of contextualizing painting through anything other than secular terms. And I think that Derek has brought that very helpfully home to roost. I think those are my main points.
Thanks very much, Casey. So, criticality, or the notion of socio-political legitimization of practice, which was initiated, if you like, by the avant-garde. And defining avant-garde, I'd like to go right back to Dada, which came out of the aftermath of the First World War. So suddenly art becomes obliged to adopt a politicized legitimacy in order to exist. Does this therefore elide an aesthetic aspect? Does beauty then become optional? Are the two necessarily mutually exclusive? And marrying them, there seem to be two streams of thoughts actually going through the paper. And on the other side, brought in by Danto and Eakins, the notion of expression related to the alchemical trope, which is one which is particularly apposite to the practice of painting due to the fact that we're working with raw material. The transformative action of the artist is, in this case, and I agree with Katie here, mediated through what could be seen as a very male-orientated or macho notion of the heroic artist in the studio transforming these raw base materials into something wonderful, into an aesthetic production, if you like. Is that aesthetic production valid without a socio-political or critical underpinning? Were the two ever separated? Surely the notion of a socio-political legitimacy in art goes right back at least to the Renaissance, if not before. Particularly was maybe more overtly expressed during the Baroque and Rococo, and then in the 19th century Salon. What I'd like to do is ask some very short questions from the floor. People would like to ask the artist a short question which might initiate a longer answer.
The primacy, you seem to be alluding, and I'm not quite sure what you mean by emotive, but you seem to be alluding to a return to a primacy, where the act of painting deactivates. And that seems to be, you seem to be suggesting that it's a kind of non-mediated, or the limit of mediation between the painter and what they do. Does that?
I'm not.
It's a question of mediation.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's my intention entirely. What I have done is taken, as a few of us have done, is taken Elkins as a sort of stalking horse, to use your expression, a reference point by which we can determine other positions. And I think the idea that he perhaps is putting forward is one of the romanticised genius, the male author, the using the seductive, beautiful paint, agonising over completion and perfection, etc. Now, I think probably most of us know where we stand in relation to that historical kind of precepts. What I'm interested in doing is coming from a late postmodern position with the conceptualizing process that we all inherently adopt and espouse through our teaching. Mario, for example, was talking about what I found more helpful for myself is Danto's other writings in combination with this. And this idea that we're perhaps at a post-historical moment and at a self-conscious philosophical context is the one which might be posited as a way forward, and that there are no disclaimers about that. There are no kind of rules defined yet about how that might function outside of this Christian linear idea of progress, which I think is characterized in avant-garde culture. So I'm talking about the optical encounter, the aesthetic experience, the visceral nature of the surface of paint and materiality. Not to suggest that we try and go back in time, but to talk about these qualities of paint as part of its innate character as a language. What I'm trying to say by defining criticality in quite a blunt way, I have to admit, but I want to sort of define that that requirement and that that interpretive context that is part of the way art is received and mediated. It's to suggest that there are ways in which these other visual inherent qualities of painting can be conceptualized.
Katie, do you want to respond to that?
I wanted to ask Derek to clarify what you mean by post-historical. I wondered whether you meant it kind of in the context of this Schwabsky remark where he says... the painting is not there to represent the image. The image exists in order to represent the painting. That is the painting's idea of painting. So you're talking about a kind of internalized language or something.
I think what Schwabsky's talking about there is the condition of self-reflexivity. That's what I interpret him to be meaning. And the Tansy illustration marks that out quite well.
But this idea of post-history, is that in relation to that particular remark? What did you mean by...
Well, I see that as I'm responding to something that Mario suggested as a response to mixed paper, but it's in terms of how we might speculate about the position we're in now and how we go forward. And so I'm interested in restating the primacy of the medium. Dan was talking about the painting is more of an idea than a medium, and painting is more of a culture than an idea. So in reverse to that, really, I'm sort of saying the site of painting, the materiality of the surface, and this process of transmutation which historically exists in the sense of alchemy in a religious context, in a theological context. So I'm proposing that there is a way of that we may be able to look at this in a secular context, and it might provide a starting point for an alternative framework of reference, an alternative form of conceptualizing.
Okay, I'd love this to go on a bit longer. Do we have one more question from the floor? Thank you.
Video. That seemed to be taking us back to quite an old argument between the artist is engaged in something outside the work of painting versus the artist's or painting as an autonomous act, which is taking its meaning and acceptance from its own materiality. So it seemed to be sort of 1940s, 1950s, you're going from Sartre, we're going from engagement to abstract expressionism when we're looking at materiality of paint. And that notion of engagement or something, you know, beauty versus quality, quite class reframing that as a position. I'm not quite sure what that notion of engagement or alluding to something outside material seemed to get sort of slightly lost as I was. When we're going back to the notion of alchemy, engagement was kind of left hanging. I'm not quite sure, in other words, where you got us to now in terms of engagement with something which in the beginning was definitely about the work outside that of, you know, as an art object.
Yes. Well, what I was trying to set out in the paper was this idea of a prerequisite, a requirement for socio-political relevance in the intellectual content of avant-garde art, and that Danto had proposed that this was a high watermark, and it had reached a kind of extreme where the author of the work was incidental, and what was being the work constituted of documentation of a gross act of injustice, social injustice. So that represented one extreme of the argument, and what I'm interested in is this idea that the way a message is inflected, you know, it may be an overtly, explicitly political message or it may not, but the way it's inflected, emotionally and optically and aesthetically, makes a difference to how effective it is as a prompt to take action. If we understand culture as something that performs a reflective mirroring function for society in terms of us questioning the values that we hold and why we value what we value, and that we might take action about a gross injustice if we were prompted to really consider it and confront it. And I think that's the objective of art as activism.
Okay, I think I'm going to draw it to a close there. We've run over slightly, but we can pick up some of these points in the final discussion together. Is it possible for art painting to be an autonomous... Is there such a thing as painting as an autonomous activity separate from life? I think not. But we're now going to thank Derek and thank Kate. In this next section, we're going to have Mikey Cuddy and Paula Kane come to the table. And yes, they can. Okay, now we're going to have. Right, can I bring the court to order? We're going to have a presentation by the artist Mikey Cuddy, artist and writer, who is associate lecturer at Brian Shaw, amongst many other things, who will be responded to by Paula Kane, who is widely exhibited artist, and whose book launch we hope we're going to come to later.
I can't see anyone very clearly, but I haven't got reading glasses. I mean, anyway, Hello.
They can see you.
Yeah, they can see me. Well, I'm going to read from my paper, and I've practiced at home, and it takes about 10 minutes. But that's speaking slowly at home and standing up, so I don't know what'll happen here. Well, coming back to painting after a long time spent writing, I embraced the things I'd missed. And this is what I wrote at the time. What she wanted here was color. What she missed writing words was color. And moving in a space, working large and then so small, using scale. The ambition and ridiculousness of making something unwieldy, unfolding. Yes, the work itself unfolding in this space, the floor, over the walls surrounding her. However, color needs the visceral, the choosing and mixing of paint. She found, coming back to painting, that it was at once exhilarating and terrifying. The choices and the lack of control, the mixing and dripping. She was surprised at how emotional it made her feel. She wrote, sorry, I was meant to change the slide here, but I don't want to weep with pain, the visceral, close to, I can't see my teeth, tears, colored tears, uncontrollable, seeping. Drawing is my thing, pieces of paper, lines, defined, flamboyant, expressive, descriptive. My hand guides them, guides the lines. The watery paint seeps, runs over the paper, onto the floorboards, to the room or rooms below, running down a wall perhaps, and onto things. At first, I think I have control, brushing watery down the canvas, but beneath the canvas, a pool of color, a magenta pool, gathers quickly, the polythene holding it in place, but only just. Imagining painting. In my text on Paula Kane's work, one of the women protagonists in the text, it's not clear who, says, "I will never make paintings like this again." It's not a pronouncement, but more of a declaration. It's almost as if it's impossible for her to imagine that time or place where the painting was made. It's almost as if the painting is one thing, and painting it is something else. Why is that? Remembering painting. This is something I wrote down when I was trying to remember what it was like to paint in a way that I no longer painted. I've written it in the third person because I find it easier somehow. When she was younger, not all that much younger, but before she was a mother, she painted on the floor, big canvases stapled down, and she drew big shapes. She painted them in and washed them out, carrying into the studio buckets of water, big expensive sponges, washing and dabbing, looming over and in it all, tending like a garden. There was control with the lines, and then there wasn't with the color and water. Sometimes the whole thing was like a big myopic pool. And then there was the end bit when she took it off the floor and stapled it, precarious, up a ladder onto the wall and stood back so she could really see it. It was only then that there was distance. So I go on to the issue of intimacy and distance. Paula lays her wall out on the floor first, and I wrote in my text for her work that she's in amongst it all, arranging. So to be in amongst it all implies an intimacy that can't be found standing in an easel or upright in front of a wall. It is only in that final act of detachment, by putting the work up onto the wall and standing away, that she actually achieves distance. So what does this bring to the work, and what does this bring to the viewer? How can one keep an intimate or close relationship with the subject, the painting, while at the same time standing away from it. With this closeness, image is embedded in process, and the process is inextricably linked to the body. In his essay, Landscapes of Painting, on the artist Elizabeth McGill, Andrew Wilson writes, "Each painting starts out lying flat on the floor of her studio, and it is here that the ground for the image is constructed. Repetitive washes of different colors provide a luminous field, or alternatively, brushstrokes cast veils over the images of rejected paintings in an act of covering over or covering up, on top of which a new painting might come to exist. Although virtually all of her paintings have this source in photographs," he goes on to say, "once finished, they appear as if they've been summoned up out of the painted ground rather than applied on top of it." So I'm interested in how the painters I admire, although incredibly diverse in their outcomes, working with race, gender, landscape, narrative, abstraction, they all use this strategy of intimacy or of being in their work when they paint. The artist Ellen Gallagher, who recently showed at the South London Gallery, works over an intense period of time. And in my favorite series from the late 90s, she says, when she's talking about this work, "I'm interested in both the painting's immediate appearance and what it can manifest slowly. And maybe that is what links me to a more modernist sensibility. I'm interested in the way materials manifest meaning in the paint, the lines, the ink, the drawings." Literally sitting on the canvas, she works over the top of a grid of calligraphy paper, which is laid over the canvas beforehand. And that can be read both sheet to sheet and as an overall skin, as in the previous painting. She uses plasticine, oil, rubber, pencil, drawing and painting into the pages after they've all been laid down. And she says, "You have to come and just, I can't see my B's. You have to come and just
be
in my work." Sorry, I've practiced that over and over and I haven't been able to say it anyway. So she's asking the viewer to enter into the work in the same way, in the same spirit that she's approached it. Other artists, such as Laura Owens, take an ideological approach. And she says, "I've always thought that instead of making a day fit into your painting, you should make the painting fit into your day. Painting should fit into your life." The artist Vic Munez writes, "Watching someone paint has very little to do with looking at a painting." And in an essay of his entitled Undertow, about his wife, the artist Nena Schaefer, in the catalogue for her exhibition Chimera, which was held at the Irish Museum of Modern Art last year, he writes, "I follow her careless choreography as she moves back from the large canvas, squinting with perplexity and insecurity. Only two in an unbroken movement step forth with a loaded brush and wound the whiteness of the canvas's surface with the resolve of an Olympic fencer. As the forms proliferate, I cling to their likeness, to things I know, only to be deceived by the continuous change they suffer. And I confess that each time they change, I suffer a little with them. Leaf-like shapes mutate into garish browns with bright yellow highlights, like bearing the memory of fresh spring mornings of childhood's past." And he goes on, "As I mourn the layers and meanings buried under the fresh wetness of the painting's present, I hopelessly try to predict her moves and to imagine what the painting will be when it is dry and seemingly dead, and anticipate when its skin will sustain this mysterious undertow of frightening creative freedom. I love her so much. Why do paintings have to dry?" Thank you.
Thanks very much, Michael. Paula, would you like to...
Okay. So some responses. Mikey's text. Okay, I like that Mikey discusses distance. and her deliberate attempt to postpone distance in making her work. That is, what she's written is, that is, only when it goes on the wall does she then choose to reflect upon it. I'm interested in how painters choose to trick ourselves into finding ways to be lost inside the process, how we engineer strategies to kickstart, then get absorbed within the act of making. Now, I've just realised I haven't done my slides, have I?
Shall we, how do we get out of here now? How to get out?
Nick?
How do we get back out? That's a slideshow, isn't it?
Have you got them in another PowerPoint?
I think there's added. Yes, I think.
Yeah. You just got one, haven't you?
No, oh no, there's a few. Right. Then I just press that one, don't I?
Yeah, no, hold on. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, right. Sorry about that. I think I'll start again. Okay. So Maggie discusses distance and her deliberate attempt to postpone distance in making her work. To quote her, that is, only when it goes on the wall does she then choose to reflect upon it. And I'm interested in how painters choose to trick ourselves into finding ways to be lost inside the process, how we engineer strategies to kickstart and get absorbed within the act of making. And this, I believe, is very important, otherwise do we not risk making illustrations of ideas. The painter Carol Dunham, in a talk he gave to accompany the exhibition Painting Process, Process Painting, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, for the exhibition, stated, "Whenever I've had an idea to make a painting, it's been a disaster. Basically, the only way I can find my paintings is in painting." And then he goes on to say, "It's more like channeling than thinking. I do find this channeling idea quite romantic and ideal. And I don't mean that cynically. I would love to be in that position. I don't even think it's a bit hippie or lacking in rigor, but a deliberate strategy to postpone distance and trust yourself, whether that be your instincts, experience, or in your methodology. It highlights the importance of measuring your work, success or otherwise, after the event, in the act of reflection that comes once something is made, and how that may feed into what goes after it, the future work. I guess what Carol Dunham is advocating is, like Mikey, the necessity to be inside a process, not maintaining distance but actively delaying it. The importance of seeking a closeness to making may seem obvious to some, but that certainly wasn't the case, as I remember it anyway, when I was a student in the mid-90s, when distance and objectivity seemed paramount. Perhaps the current resurgence of interest in romantic subject matter also permits an arguably more romantic approach to making. To briefly touch on Mikey's observations on the terrifying prospect of making paintings, followed by her observation that the painting is one thing and painting is something else, I'm wondering if it's the making of the painting that's terrifying, or making the painting public that's so scary. This raises questions of who the painting is for at different times in its life cycle, during the private space of the studio, and how it becomes transformed when made public. Perhaps there's a question for the audience. When we read a painting, to what extent are we reading the image or the activity that produced it? And how can or should this ever be separated? Keeping with the terrifying aspect of making paintings, as someone who finds fewer things more alienating than attending one of my own private views, I find myself continually shocked by seeing my work outside of my studio. Physically, the edges are more pronounced. There is no blurring between where the painting ends and where the rest of the studio practice resides. Its relationship to space shifts dramatically. Psychologically, it seems akin to having your diary read aloud in a public space. Yet I acknowledge that painting is a public act that demands a response from an audience, that asks an audience to participate in it. And I find the question of painting as a verb and painting as a noun very interesting, and maybe something we can come back to. Okay, so now to return to where Mikey's proposition of painters delaying and distancing tactics again. Russell Ferguson in Pocket, number 65, discusses Laura Owen's methodology and her preparatory work, which takes the form of many painted sketches. He writes, "These studies delay the actual start of the work on the large canvas, which requires a slow build-up of momentum. All the delays," Owen says, "are like a trick of the brain to make you think it's fail-safe. It also wears you out so that you can do it. If I start, I'm a little too self-aware." Ferguson draws the comparison. Athletes often have elaborate rituals that they must carry out before their events. Their purpose is not merely to appease superstition, they also serve to calm the nerves and empty out the mind, so that when the time comes to perform, action will not be impeded by too much conscious effort. So for me, this touches on the place of ritual and habit within the studio. Further to this, I question to what extent do each of us exercise control over our work? As someone who likes work very different from my own, and desperately attempt to make work that's quite different to my own, and so I try to initiate different approaches to making and process, yet I always seem to end up making a similar kind of painting. I think I must be doing this wrong. So perhaps I'm fooling myself into thinking that I'm fully in control of my work. So I come back to Mikey's question. How can one keep an intimate or close relationship to the subject, the painting, while at the same time standing away from it? With this closeness, image is embedded in process, and the process is inextricably linked to the body. Inextricable link is, I believe, revealed in Elizabeth McGill's approach. As a viewer, I read this image by how it plays off its means of production by slowly revealing itself. Yves Allembois, in Painting as Model, references Meyer Shapiro's Marxist characterization of painting's physical status. The emphasis on touch, on texture, and on gesture in modern painting is a consequence of the division of labor inherent in industrial production. Industrial capitalism banished the hand from the process of production. The work of art alone, as craft, still implied manual handling, and therefore artists were compelled by reaction to demonstrate the exceptional nature of their mode of production. Although Meyer's text is from 1978, could it not still be argued that this revealing of production is not even more important today? This reminds me of a recent conversation I had with Stephen Carter, who's principal lecturer at Byam Shaw, when we were considering if painting has not got an even greater responsibility to reference its production and processes. Now that we live in an age of emails and word processing and Photoshop and CGI, and with regards to the body, with increased amounts of bodily modifications such as Botox, does this not give painting an increased responsibility, an ideal opportunity to reveal its history? When signs of process and arriving at are increasingly less visible, we seem to live in a world where erasure is the norm. Does this not make it incumbent upon painting to be a record of its own process, including its mistakes and flaws? I remember a few years ago seeing two painting shows around the same time, and one was a Glen Brown show and the other Peter Doig. And I came away from the Glen Brown show feeling dissatisfied that the paintings were too consistent. Consistently good, but I felt that there was something missing. And with the Peter Doig show, it was a very different experience. I thought that some of the paintings in that show weren't so strong, but I found it much more interesting and satisfying, a show, and all the better for seeing some howlers. Yet I felt it to be an altogether better show for me. And I was wondering, is there a problem with the completeness of a Glen Brown for me as a member of the audience? And therefore, does it follow as a viewer that I feel more in a position to finish a painting such as a Peter Doig? So I guess the truth is that images are difficult things to read. The surface of a painting absorbs more than iconography. It is a document of every decision, indecision, hesitation, and emotion that comes into contact with it. Therefore, I'd like to propose that it's only through reading a process or in reading a methodology that which is indescribable can be expressed through a reading of the process.
Thanks very much, Paula. Thank you. I think we're talking here very much of the viscerality of painting, or more truly the viscerality of the act of painting and its relation to the body. If you like, almost in an anti-heroic way. It's as if it's the very act of making the painting is where the life of the painting is. Mm-hmm. And to quote Mickey, quoting, I can't remember who it was now, your friend, when the painting's dead, when it's finished, it's dry, it's dead. It's almost like, does the life come into the painting when it's complete, or does it go out of it? Mm-hmm. Has it already lived its life? Mm-hmm. And we are looking at the aftermath, or the corpse of the painting. Mm-hmm. What's really important is the intimacy of the act of painting, and its link to the body. And this bears not only on a sort of poetic notion of the production, if you like, but does also link back to Derek's metaphoric use of the trope of alchemy. that it is a process, but it is a process that leaves a trace. I think Paula's reference to the word painting, it is both a verb and a noun. Mm. And there's almost a battle between the two. We have on the one hand an object, and on the other we have an act. And I think the punctum lies between the two, when a painting in the old-fashioned sense works, if you like, or when certain paintings have a phenomenal effect, a widespread effect. It's when they manage to, if you like, straddle that balance between the verb and the noun of painting. Are there any questions from the floor? A question from the floor? A room full of painters and no questions from the floor.
We answered them all.
Writing is quite interested in your relationship between writing and painting. Maybe something intrigues it earlier in the day, but we didn't really have time to pursue that, which was that she felt she could be, you said, felt you could be painterly in your writing. And I wondered if there was any more you could say about that kind of relationship.
I've been thinking a lot, I mean, recently about how they're different, actually, because for me, the way I work anyway, painting requires a particular space, you know, taking up a space. And with writing, the space is secret or private, you know, it can be anywhere, it can be on the back of an envelope, or, you know, so I see them as quite different. I have used text in my work, but I haven't used text in a kind of narrative way. They've been found texts of my own, or, you know, old lists or letters, but they've just been used almost as a way of drawing rather than writing. There's a sort of inscribed, that there have been inscribed bits of narrative in the work, but not whole text. That doesn't really answer the question, I guess. But I have enjoyed writing about my work. It helps me to sort of understand it more. I think.
Do you see the sequence of writing as something that gives it a kind of power that you would like preserved somehow in painting as well, or is that misleading?
I think painting is always harder for me to do, and therefore I keep sort of plugging away at it almost, because it's so, you have to create space for it and time and selfish time, and I guess with writing I can be quite secretly selfish in a way, and it's more fragmented as well. It's more kind of cut up, and then it's all brought together. So I don't think, yeah.
Okay, and I think
thank
we have
you,
one more
thanks.
Question.
Zooming in, maybe this is what I was saying before, trying to establish what specifically is going on now in the discussion that's not something emotional, something we've heard before. I was thinking about you, the comment you made that sort of picked up on about painting a noun and a verb, and the same is also true of the process, obviously, and the same is also true of distinctions that were being made, say, about Carl and making lists of now poems, which were nouns, and which you say are throwing, and saying, oh, maybe in sculptures, the question of noun and verb was happening at that point. I'm just wondering I'm just trying to tease out something a bit more about the distinctions you would make between the descriptions of other people's work and your own. I'm just trying to tease out maybe a bit more about what you meant by that.
Yeah, I think maybe it does go back to, you know, I was kind of talking about being a student in the, you know, in the 90s, and how sort of completeness, or, you know, having a kind of a watertightness to your work is seemed like that was how, you know, you're supposed to, you know, progress with making a work, you know, to have your ideas, to know what your work's about. And I guess at the moment, perhaps I'm just in a
I'm in a space where I don't really know what my work's about, and maybe that's what I like about other people's work, is when it has a kind of element of incompleteness to it, or you don't really know what you're looking at. And I just, at the moment, I find that really interesting. And so I guess, you know, that maybe reflects to things that are perhaps got a different kind of physicality to them, and that are maybe more about the act of making than about an idea of sort of completeness or watertightness.
Is that, that's in opposition to, if you like, sort of the notion that you have to eventually achieve distance. And the only way to achieve, sort of, to achieve the work or to find the work is to lose yourself in it. Mm-hmm. So you go from a position of immersion in the work, almost non-verbal immersion, to a point inevitably where it goes out into the world and you have that distance from it.
If ever,
they cling on to you.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to expand some of these ideas and hopefully bring in some new ones in a round table involving all the speakers this afternoon and Vanessa and Jackson from this morning. But for the moment, I'd like to thank Paula and Mikey for their presentation.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're just going to have a short half-hour break now and recommence at 4 o'clock.
Oh, they've been done with. Oh,
I wish I'd drink.